This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Happy New Year, everyone. The topic on this segment of Your Legal Rights is multi-parent families for children in the dependency system, and we'll tell you what that means in case this is not familiar to you. My guests are Andrew Kane, chair of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. He's the supervising attorney of Legal Advocates for Children and Youth, the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. My other guest, who is very helpful to me and has been suggesting to me topics and guests, and so it's great to have her on the program. It's Deborah Wald, a member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section, and her firm is the Wald Law Group in San Francisco. Funding for Your Legal Rights, this particular segment is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar. Additional funding of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. I welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Let's do this. What are we talking about in terms of multi-parent families for children in the dependency system?
So just to broaden the topic slightly, we actually would love to talk about children in the dependency system and also children not in the dependency system.
Fine, good.
And I think that the starting place is just to stop and think about how a child would end up having more than two parents. And to get there, it's important to remember historically that up until maybe 50 years ago, we didn't actually have a good way to know who a child's biological father was. We knew who the biological mother was because she gave birth. But figuring out who fathers were was 100% a social policy decision. And typically, we just assigned the father role to the man who was married to the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And children born to unwed mothers were bastards, and they were illegitimate. They didn't have fathers. There was no man legally responsible for them. And so, you know, over the last 50 years or so, we've been trying to figure out, I guess I'd have to use the word better ways of deciding who parents are, and we've broadened our thinking. And we also, of course, have developed new scientific techniques. So we still have those same old rules. The mm-hmm. men married to mothers are legally presumed to be the fathers of the children. But we also now can tell who the biological father is. And particularly in California, we also have come to take very seriously the child's experience of who their parents are. We really look at who's been raising this child. Who does this child think its mother is? Who does this child think its father is? And give some real weight to that in our court system. So with all of those different ways of thinking about who's a parent, you can end up with more than two people who qualify. You know,
well, if I may ask you this, when you say two people who qualify, there can be one male who actually impregnated the woman or perhaps is a sperm donor for someone. But then you can have someone else who may have been, as you say, married to the mother who gave birth. How do you determine, for example, if there is someone who is actually the father of the child, and let's say not a sperm donor, how do we deal with that person who perhaps may have some responsibility for support of the child? Or is that an issue that we even need to deal with on this segment of Your Legal Rights?
Well, I mean, that's exactly how we end up in these situations where you have, I mean, every child does have a biological mother and a biological father, for sure. But those people aren't necessarily their legal parents because of the marital presumptions is the most typical way that can end up not being true. So again, if a married woman gives birth, her husband is that child's legal father and the biological.
And responsible for support.
And responsible for support,
yes.
Whether or not he's the child's biological father.
So may I ask you something, if you don't mind, briefly. What if we have a sperm donor?
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding, and by the way, family law is not my bailiwick. I think you know this.
Mm-hmm.
But I find this an interesting question, and I hope you'll indulge me just for a moment. A sperm donor, a child is born, The sperm donor never thought he would have any responsibility for child support. Under this new law, which apparently became effective for multiple parents January 1st of this year, could he possibly end up having responsibility for supporting the child?
If you want a yes or no, could he possibly? The answer is yes, but
really?
There'd have to be a number of steps to get him there.
Okay, maybe so, that's another program.
You know, I mean, I can do it for you very briefly. A sperm donor is a sperm donor. We have a legal definition of sperm donors in California, and I'm not going into all of that because that's beyond it. But if a man qualifies as a sperm donor under our legal definitions, that qualification will preclude him from using biology to establish his parental relationship.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it would preclude the Department of Child Support Services or the mother from holding him financially responsible based on his biological relationship to the child.
Mm-hmm.
If he goes on to actually parent that child, then we have an open question, actually, whether he could sort of reinvent his relationship, not based on biology, but based on his relationship.
So if the mother is married to somebody else, and let's say perhaps she's given birth to the child before the marriage that she's entered into with someone else. At some point, the biological father could come in and say, I would like to be involved as a parent with this child, and that's how we have potentially three parents.
So most typically outside the dependency system, and I'll let Andrew talk in a minute about sort of typically how this happens in the dependency system, but most typically outside the dependency system, we would have had usually a younger couple that got pregnant not intentionally.
Yes.
They will have entered into something called a voluntary declaration of paternity at the hospital, which hospitals are actually financially incentivized to get because they make it easier to collect child support, to make very clear at birth who the child's mother is and who the child's father is.
Mm-hmm.
Those young couples who accidentally have children together often don't stay together.
Yes, yeah.
So,
when you say young couples, they're probably not married.
Right. Not married.
They're not
younger
married.
Couple.
It happened because,
it happened.
Hey.
Right. Kid was born.
Yeah.
That kid typically ends up with mom.
Mm-hmm.
And if mom is fit, that kid typically does not end up in the dependency system. But she often will go on to fall in love with someone and form a stable relationship.
Yes.
And that child often will be raised by mom and this new man that mom has become committed to, and he'll be that child's functional father. But the biological father may very well still be around, may be there on birthdays and spend some vacations and, you know, love the child and the child love him, even though he's not in that primary parenting role. And that's a very, very typical scenario for a child ending up with really meaningful relationships with three parents.
So how does the dependency system get involved with this, with multiple parents?
So before I directly answer that question, if I can maybe just take a step back talk a little bit about the legislation that got us to this point, because I think it's important to have an understanding of the road that we took to get here and what the legislature is intending in ultimately passing this and then the governor signing it. The idea behind this legislation, which if anybody's interested in looking up the history, was Senate Bill 274 in the California legislature of 2013. The idea was to have a process in place whereby a child who recognizes somebody as their parent, but that person may somehow be precluded from establishing that parental relationship, to be able to have a system in place that allows a court to recognize that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because the last thing that the people who were behind this bill wanted to see happen, and the legislature wanted to see happen, was you have a kid who's going through the dependency system or going through another court system, and you have somebody who is stepping up and saying, I want to be this child's parent. I want to take on the responsibilities. I want to have the rights associated with being that, but then have some provision in the law that blocks them from doing so. So when we're talking about this bill specifically, which is now law, what we're talking about is, protecting children, allowing children to have that person in their life who really wants to be committed to them help nurture them, raise them, and have all the responsibilities that are associated with that.
So what happens in the dependency system? I mean, you know, there may be a good number of us listening to both of you. What is the dependency system? What's going on?
So the juvenile dependency system is the court arm of the state's child welfare system.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever a county child welfare agency believes that a child has been the victim of abuse or neglect, mm-hmm. they file a petition alleging whatever the acts or conduct is that rises to the level of abuse or neglect. And then they seek to get a court to ultimately adjudge that child to be a dependent of the court. In mm-hmm. most instances, when a child welfare agency is getting involved, they are seeking an order removing the child from the care of the parent.
I see.
And then placing that child into foster care or relative care or the care of a family friend. Mm-hmm. Not always. Sometimes kids in the juvenile dependency system maintain mm-hmm. their custodial relationships with their parents. When a juvenile dependency action is filed, one of the first things that a court has to do is to establish a parental relationship. And in most instances in juvenile dependency cases, what we're talking about is a father coming in mm-hmm. and trying to establish a parental relationship. And as Deborah was alluding to, the law is written in a way such that there are multiple ways in which you can establish parentage. But the bottom line is, prior to this bill becoming law, a juvenile dependency court, just like any other court, could only recognize two individuals mm-hmm. as the parents of this child.
Mm-hmm.
How it practically plays out in a juvenile dependency case in some instances, which is why from a juvenile dependency perspective, I believe this law is important, is you have a situation where the family was involved in another court system at some earlier point, or perhaps there was a voluntary declaration of paternity signed. The individual who had previously been adjudged to be this child's parent, either in that prior court proceeding or pursuant to the voluntary declaration.
We're talking about the male?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
That person, for whatever reason, has now chosen not to be involved in that child's life.
Mm.
But previously, under the existing law, the court was left with no recourse to find somebody else who is stepping up to the plate to have a parental relationship. And Deborah right now is working on a case on behalf of my office in which we had sort of that exact situation where mm-hmm. a child had an individual who was asserting that he wanted to be this child's father, but because there had been a prior order out there, that person was not able to be able to establish the parental relationship. So what this is doing in those situations is now saying, if you want to step up to the plate, if you want to be this child's parent, we are now creating a legal mechanism where if you walk through a couple steps, you'll be able to do so. And that can be, in some instances, critically important for that child.
Why did this happen at this point, effective January 1st of 2014? What happened that would cause the legislature and the governor to say, what we need to do now is be able to recognize that there can be more than two parents?
This law actually came out of a specific case down in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And there's kind of a constant dialogue between the court system and the legislature. And this
they do talk to each other?
They don't talk to each other directly, but
only in the dark corners. Okay.
Right. But the courts periodically will identify a problem, but say this is not a problem that it's appropriate for the courts to solve. This is a problem.
For the legislature.
If it's going to be solved, mm-hmm. it has to be solved by the legislature. And so there was a case a few years ago now, I think it was in 2011, where a highly dysfunctional lesbian couple in the L.A. area, on again, off again, and during off again, one of the women got involved with a man. Mm-hmm. She got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And while pregnant, then came back to her long-term female partner. They got married in preparation
for the child.
Got married in preparation for the child being born. So the mm-hmm. child was born into their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So the non-genetic mother was presumed to be that child's second parent through the marital presumption.
Yes.
the mother had some very serious, the biological mother had some very serious mental health and substance abuse issues. Mm-hmm. That relationship only lasted a few weeks after the child was born. That is between the two women.
Mm-hmm.
Mom then went off and got involved with another man. And ultimately, that other man tried to kill the non-biological mother. So this is total mayhem.
The non-biological mother?
Mother. Tried to get rid of her because she was asserting parental rights to the child, the mother was upset. Mom ended up in prison.
Yeah.
The non-biological mother ended up in the hospital.
Mm.
And the child ended up in the dependency courts.
Yeah.
And that was a situation where the dependency judge looked at this picture and said, I want to preserve this baby's relationship with the non-biological mother, but she is not capable of providing consistent, regular care. I can't actually place the child with her.
Yes.
But we have this biological father who's actually willing to step up and take responsibility and take that baby home with him.
Mm-hmm.
But here, this was the exact situation. So we have mom. Mom's not going anywhere, even though she's in prison at that moment. She's the one who's clear, and the court was left having to choose between these two people, both of whom were blameless in this situation and really wanted to keep both in the picture. And so the dependency court said, I'm counting to three. I'm going to, you know, sort of break the rules here and find they're all three parents.
Wow.
And the court of appeal said, and they really essentially said this, we understand exactly what you were trying to do, and we understand why you wanted to do it. But counting to three is a big enough step. The legislature has to tell us it's okay to do
that. They reversed the decision.
They reversed the decision, but you know, put out a very clear statement that they were looking for legislative guidance.
Wow.
And SB 274 is the legislative guidance they were looking for.
Incredible. Just incredible. Now, you told me before we went on the air, Andrew, that Governor Brown, a similar proposed legislation had come before Governor Brown in 2012, and he vetoed it.
That's correct.
What caused him to see the light here?
So every time a governor vetoes a piece of legislation, I shouldn't say every time. Most times the governor vetoes a piece of legislation, there will be an accompanying message indicating why the governor chose not to endorse that bill. The veto message that Governor Brown signed here indicated that there were some concerns about the breadth of the legislation in 2012, that essentially that it might be opening doors in too many instances for courts to be adjudging that a child has more than two parents. So when the group that was working with the author's office went back to the table in 2013 to try to get this legislation crafted in a way that would be amenable to the governor, language was included essentially expressing the intent of the legislature that this is a provision that is to be applied in limited circumstances.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And from a legal point of view, the standard is detriment. If it would be detrimental to the child for a court not to recognize more than two parents, then the court should go forward recognizing more than two parents. If the court does not make that detriment finding, then the court should not be recognizing more than two parents for that child.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think it's important to have this particular discussion is I've been in meetings and I've heard other people since the legislation was signed by the governor back in October, I believe it was, where they've talked about the possibility of sort of the floodgates opening for this and having to deal in every case with the possibility of having more than two parents.
Mm-hmm.
And we as attorneys and judges, we have a responsibility to implement the law as the legislature intended. And I believe the legislature intended, and I think they made it explicit by including that intent language, to have this apply in limited circumstances where it really is the right thing to do for that child to recognize more than two parents.
I know that the law takes into account the best interests of the child. If the child cannot talk, let's say we're talking about someone who's very young or has limited ability to express his or her feelings about something, do we put the child in a situation, if the court determines that there will be three parents, or maybe there could be more than three parents, does the court determine or try to figure out, can this be confusing to this young child as the young child gets older?
So I would be shocked, frankly. I would be shocked if any court used this law to create a multi-parent scenario for a child that wasn't already in existence.
I see.
So
I
the
see
concept
what you're saying.
Here truly
okay.
is to avoid, I mean, mm-hmm. to avoid children losing important uh-huh. parental
okay.
figures.
Gotcha.
And so I would expect the court to actually use this law to maintain stability and to maintain the status quo for children, mm-hmm. where without this law, they would have had to cut off an important relationship and change that child's experience, rather than to create some new experience for a child. I would truly be shocked if I saw a court using it in that way.
Now, my understanding is, from what you've told me before we went on the air, is that this new law, SB 274, also applies in an adoption situation, can apply in an adoption situation.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Now, we had, so it's, I can't tell you what year, but years ago, the California Supreme Court endorsed something called a limited consent adoption, which allows a birth parent to consent to what we've typically called a second parent adoption, mm-hmm. to consent to an adoption of their child without termination of their own parental rights.
I see.
And when the Supreme Court did that, actually the dissent in that decision dissented partly on the ground that allowing limited consent adoptions opened the door to a child ending up with more than two parents through the adoption process. Mm. And the Supreme Court's response, which was a very typical response of the Supreme Court, was, yes, I guess that's possible, but that's not the case before us, so we won't worry about that today.
Mm.
But it's been kind of hanging out there for years now that that might be a possibility. And so SB 274 clarified that, in fact, limited consent is possible and acknowledged, statutorily acknowledged, that that could end up with a child having more than two parents.
And the limited consent is necessary in an adoption situation. The limited consent, well, if for example... And help me on this if I'm just totally off the wall on this. The limited consent, is that only on the behalf of the biological mother, or would it be also a limited consent on the part of, let's say, the biological father?
So if we're adding a third parent,
yes.
it could easily be both.
I see. Okay.
So a full consent to an adoption implies termination of the birth parent's parental rights.
I
That's
gotcha.
Your typical
okay.
adoption, is someone's consenting
yes.
to adoption of their child and their own rights are then terminated.
Mm-hmm.
So limited consent is consenting to adoption without one's own rights being terminated. And again, typically that would be to add a second parent. Now it could be to add a third parent, in which case both initial parents would have to give their limited consent.
Let me ask you this then, with my limited knowledge about family law. In a situation where perhaps under this new law, there's a petition for to be at least three parents. Does the court appoint a separate attorney to represent the child's interest?
They can. I have a case pending right now.
So you could have three. You could have three at least three lawyers in this case, possibly.
Or four. If you have one for the child and three parents.
Okay.
The family courts typically do not appoint counsel for children unless they feel the child is being caught in the crossfire.
Yes.
And needs to have their own voice in the process.
Who pays, if that is the case, if the court believes that the child needs to be represented in a crossfire situation and the court appoints an attorney, who's responsible to pay that attorney?
The state.
The state. Okay. Yep. All right. Okay.
So for what it's worth, in a juvenile dependency proceeding, the protections for parties are a little bit stronger. Parents in a juvenile dependency action are entitled to court-appointed counsel. they have the right to retain their own counsel, but if they can't, they get court-appointed counsel.
Really? Okay, paid for but by the state or the county?
By the state. And the child, it's not a statutory entitlement to counsel. Mm-hmm. The way the law is written, it says that if the court finds that the child would benefit from having counsel, the court shall appoint counsel for that child. In practice, most, if not all, California counties do end up appointing counsel for all children mm-hmm. in juvenile dependency matters. But because in a juvenile dependency case, we're sometimes talking about sibling groups, not just individual children.
Yes.
And within sibling groups, you could have multiple fathers. We're talking sometimes four, five, six. I think the most I've ever seen is seven attorneys in one case.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. With how many kids in that particular case you're talking about?
Now you're really testing my
memory. No, that's all right. That's okay. That's okay.
A handful.
A handful of kids. Oh, my gosh. Well, all right. For those of you who are listening to this program live, we will continue into a second half hour. I will give the phone number for you to be able to call in. For those of you who are listening to us on the internet at www.kow.org, you'll also be able to call in. What I hope to let you know about is that if you are listening to us and you are listening to us live, you will be able to call in not only about what we've been talking about, SB 274, but if you have other questions in the area of family law, my guests are very, very experienced, very talented people, and they'll be able to handle your question and give you some general advice or general recommendation. I must tell you this, however, that under the state bar's ethics rules, my guests cannot give specific legal advice on the air. That's the only problem. So what we're going to do at this point, this is the end of the statewide version of the program. We will continue on a local basis and on the internet in just about a half a minute or so. All right. It is 7:28 and it looks like a half, or maybe it's 7:27 and a half. I'm not sure. This is 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. I wish all of you if you were not with us last week on January 1st, we did a live program, by the way, on food as medicine. If you weren't with us then, I wish you a happy new year. I hope 2014 is a very good one for you. Here's our phone number, 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134, whether you're listening to us live in the Bay Area or you're listening to us live on www.kalw.org on the internet. I want to let you know that next month, believe it or not, and it's hard to believe with where all the years have gone, I will have been doing this program for 30 years. And the Family Law Section has been with me most of that time. It's been very supportive of what we've been doing. I currently am working with Deborah Wald as my liaison, or she's my liaison to the Family Law Section, suggesting topics and guests. And so I hope you are getting something out of this as we try to give some basic information. My guests are Deborah Wall, a member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. Her firm is the Wald Law Group in San Francisco. My other guest is Andrew Kane, chair of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. He's the supervising attorney of Legal Advocates for Children and Youth, the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. So I welcome you to call in with your question, your comment, whatever you feel might be good. At the end of this month, which will actually be the 29th of January, we will have our Call a Lawyer night where you'll have a chance to call in, ask questions. We'll, on that program, on the on-air program, we'll be talking about some of the more significant United States Supreme Court cases, both criminal and civil. And I think you might find that interesting, but that will be our Call a Lawyer night. And we're going to start with Steve. Welcome to the program. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey,
it's you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your anniversary upcoming for 30 years. And think about all the thousands of people that you've helped.
Pretty hard to believe, Steve.
This is a great program, especially around this time of year when we like to think about all the time that we spend with our families. either good or bad, depending on your point of view. Would your experts, Deborah and Andrew, please address, my sister went to law school at a later age in her life and told me that there was a lot of people in her class that wanted to get into this area of family law to become the child advocates. And talk about the training additional, or what advice that they would give to law students that want to get in, or young lawyers that want to get into this area. And then question two is, could they address the situation of adult adoption? I know it was in the case of the dog people, kind of in a bad point of view, but can they talk about that if there's situations for medical care or what have you that are done with adult the adopting of an adult?
That's a very good, very good question. Okay, Steve.
Great program.
Yeah, thanks so much. Happy New Year to you. Turn your radio back up. Okay, what comments do you have for someone? Unfortunately, I know as things have happened, there are now more graduates from law school than there are jobs available. So Steve's question, how can someone prepare him or herself to get involved with dealing with many of the issues of family law, et cetera. What comments do you have, Andrew, on that?
Well, I think the first point to keep in mind is exactly what you were just saying, Chuck, is that it is a competitive market.
Very difficult right now.
And as a supervisor, I do hiring in my office, and I actually just recently hired an attorney within the last 2 weeks, and I can't tell you how competitive the pool of applicants was.
How many applicants did you have, roughly?
Probably 30, 40.
Is that right? I'm surprised that few.
Yeah,
frankly, and I'm not being facetious.
Yeah, and it was, the decision was tough because the field was so competitive with quality candidates.
Yeah.
Coming from a background of working in a nonprofit field, the advice that I always give people is volunteer.
Yes, I agree.
My office in particular has a pretty good track record of hiring people who were law student interns for us, either in their summers or if they happen to have the opportunity to both work and go to school at the same time during the academic year, but also even after they get out of law school, do some volunteer, take a pro bono case, or offer yourself to do just regular volunteer hours around the office. Because the market is so competitive, we're looking for people who can differentiate themselves, sort of stand out above the crowd. And a resume is only as good as a resume.
Sure.
And so if I'm able to say, I've seen this person's work in action through volunteerism or whatever the case may be, I'm much more likely to give that person a second look.
I think that may be becoming perhaps more, not necessarily common yet, but more available to young people who want to practice law, but there are no jobs available. My office, the San Mateo County DA's office, I think it's just as of this year, actually this week, has brought in a couple of attorneys who recently passed the state bar as volunteers. No pay. The office didn't have enough money to hire a couple more people. Did have money to hire one person, but not enough. And so I think that's happening. What comments do you have, Deborah, about Steve's other question about adopting an adult?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about adult adoptions, but let me just quickly say I'm an adjunct professor at the USF Law School, and that's exactly what I tell my students. If you have an area you're passionate about, find a way to volunteer in that area. Even if you can't get a job in that area, the fact that you're spending time and volunteering your skills in that direction will help you ultimately find a job there.
Very important.
In terms of adult adoptions, first of all, the three-parent piece almost doesn't matter with an adult adoption because the requirements for consents are completely different. If the person who is adopting and the person who's being adopted both consent. Nobody else needs to be notified, and nobody else needs to consent.
Because the adult who's being adopted is an adult.
Right, and so they can consent
To
their own adoption in a way that children can't. I have been doing... So many people don't know adult adoptions exist, and unfortunately, the way many people found out about them was through that rather odd case where the woman was killed by the Presa Canaria dogs, and the owners of the dogs apparently were adopting this man in prison who had been raising. It was a crazy set of circumstances. The reality is, I've done a number of adult adoptions. There's rarely a dry eye in the house when an adult adoption is granted, because the typical scenario for an adult adoption is a scenario where the right consents couldn't be gotten for some reason while that now adult was a minor. It's a long-standing, loving relationship that finally, now that both that the child is an adult, the child has the right to consent themselves. And so they tend to be very touching, and they're very easy, actually, to accomplish. And so they typically are done either for... I think they're most typically done for estate planning purposes, honestly, to create a direct parent-child relationship because of a family trust or some other legacy purose, or just simply to cement an emotional bond that's been there for a long time.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to actually, Chuck, to interrupt. If I could just add to the last point that Deborah was making. In the juvenile dependency context, the law was amended not too long ago to allow for adult adoptions. And the reason why is because prior to January 1st, 2012, the average youth who was not able to receive a permanent home through juvenile dependency typically emancipated out of the system shortly after their 18th birthday. With the advent of AB 12, which took effect in January 1st, 2012, you now have many youth who are able to exercise what's called extended foster care and remain in the system up until the age of 21. And so since these youth are in the system, one of the things that the legislature has done is create a path for these youth to proceed with adult adoption. The reason that I wanted to latch on to Deborah's last point was because these youth typically have been in the foster care system for years, they are often looking for that emotional support that they can be provided. And so when you have a caregiver who's willing to step up and say, I will be your parent, the adult adoption, having a streamlined process where that can happen, is just such a wonderful thing for that youth.
Incredible. All right, our number, 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. My guests are Andrew Kane, chair of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar, supervising attorney of Legal Advocates for Children and Youth, the Law Foundation of Silicon Valley. My other guest is Deborah Wald, a member of the Executive Committee of the Family Law Section, and her firm is the Wald Law Group in San Francisco. So if you have a question in the area of family law, whether it relates to adoption or whether it relates to dependency or something else, maybe it relates to child support, spousal support, division of property or whatever, we welcome you to call in, ask a question, make a comment, have a chance to talk with my guests who are very experienced family lawyers. And so I would hope that you take advantage of that. And we have our next person, Ruth Ann. Ruth Ann, well, Happy New Year to you. I heard you last week, and I'm glad you're back this week.
Happy New Year to you, too. I wanted to ask your guests how they would propose, if a person has just graduated law school and is having trouble finding work of his or her choice and is hugely indebted because of loans taken out to get through law school, how are they supposed to survive and pay rent and buy food and pay back those loans at the same time you're suggesting that they volunteer in their field of choice?
This is probably the tragedy of our financial system right now, Ruth Ann.
I mean, they're not starving actors and actresses like you hear.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you But it is a very significant problem. Let me get some comments for you, okay?
Okie doke. Thanks a bunch.
Ruth Ann, thank you very much for calling. What comments do you have? I mean, this is a very difficult time.
It is.
It's the worst time in many years.
Honestly, it is. I think this is a huge conundrum for our legal education system.
I'll say.
Because to continue charging the tuitions that are being charged for young people to go to law school, knowing that they're going to graduate in debt without having jobs available, I am aware, because of my own affiliations and friends who are full-time law professors, that this is a topic that the legal education community is really grappling with.
Yes.
I don't think those of us who practice law have a solution to this issue.
Not yet.
You know, I know more than one attorney who is working, you know, catering or doing other things.
Waiting tables.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's not unusual.
Right. And then, as I say, and then, you know, my suggestion, if they have time, is that they be volunteering in their area of passion. So they'll be first in line when a job does open up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think either of us have a real answer to that question, except that I believe it does need to be answered at the law school level.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only two things that I would add to that are, first, at least with the federal government loan programs, there are various levels at which you can repay your debt. I'm not that far removed from law school, so I'm still paying back my loans right now. And there are income contingent programs available.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would recommend anybody who is struggling right now to consider whether they should be looking at how their payments are actually structured so they can manage them better at the point in time that they're going through right
now.
How would they
find that out?
Just if it's the federal government, there's, I forget what the web domain is, but the federal government has a pretty comprehensive website for student loan borrower, so that would be the place to start.
Are most of the debts that young law students or graduates of law school are subjected to, are most of these debts backed by the federal government?
Most
are.
Yeah,
okay.
There are private entities that do issue student loans, and there's a whole debate about that, and interest rates are being charged. It's going on across the country. But I think the majority of lenders are taking out their loans from the feds.
Mm-hmm. All right. We have James. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, yes.
Hi, James.
Hi. Well, I'm from Africa, and I got hurt some time ago, and I was giving some loans, some money. But because of the war in Liberia, I spent all that money on my five brothers that were killed there, and I spent the money on their wives and children. Then I didn't know I was going to have children, so I have a tie with a lady.
Who is not your wife, is that right?
Right. And then she told me the tie was for the white guy, but then it turned out to be black. So I asked the social worker to see if she's, you know, it could be my son.
Okay. And the woman, the mother of the child, she is not someone who is in favor of your spending time with the child or
right.
not?
Right. She don't want me to be the father. She keeps,
I see.
Okay. Okay. So the social worker say, well, do you want me to do a test on you? I said, sure. Then she asked me if she could do a background check on me. So I said, I got nothing to hide.
Okay.
Then a month and a half later, no result. So I called 2 months later. She said, well, the judge didn't order me, therefore they're not obligated to give me a result. So I kept calling. I said, you knew that the judge didn't order me, but you did. So you got to tell me whether I'm his father or not.
So let me stop you, James, for just a moment. Are you saying you went before a court and the court ordered that a test be done of you?
No. The social worker told me to ask me to give my swap.
Okay. I understand that. I misunderstood you. So what county are you in?
I'm in San Francisco.
Oh, you are. Okay. What about the... what is it, the family law, what is it, the county agency that is helpful to people who can't afford a lawyer?
Are you talking about the self-help center or the family law facilitator?
James, let me. James, don't say anything for a minute. I want to get an answer from my guest here. Yeah, the self-help center. Is this something that he should go to, the self-help center in San Francisco?
So typically if somebody calls my office and it's an issue that we are unable to help with because it doesn't fall within our nonprofit guidelines, one of the places that we would refer that person to is in Santa Clara County, our self-help center. Self-help centers, one of the subject areas that they assist with is family law, things like establishing parentage, child support actions, things of that nature.
And there is, James, and I'm not sure what San Francisco calls it, but there is generally across the state of California family law facilitators' offices where you can go in and they can, at no charge to you, because they're employed by the counties. They can give you some help in trying to accomplish something. I take it you're not in a position that you can afford an attorney. Is that right?
Exactly. But when I asked them the question, they said someone called from the lab and said I wasn't the father. Then I said, well, why don't you give me a result? Then she shot at me. She said, oh, you want a result? I will give it to you. So she gave me the paper, and then I took it to the office where they pay child support, and the person put the case number in the computer, and somebody else's name came up. My name was nowhere in
there. I see. Okay. Well, my suggestion is you have not been in San Francisco. You have not been to the self-help center?
Well, I tried to go to a self-help center. They said, well, the people said you are not the father, so nothing we can do.
And what office was that that you went to?
It's a place where you go in the courthouse.
Okay.
The office there.
Okay, it sounds like. But go ahead, please, Deborah.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, generally speaking, if someone believes that they are the parent of a child and they are being denied access to that child and they need the court to order a DNA test or other court intervention, they can file a petition. It's called a petition to establish parental relationship.
Yeah.
And that will get them in front of the court.
Yeah.
And in a situation like this, presumably the first thing the court would do would be to order DNA testing.
Yes.
If the test comes back that he's not the father, then he's not likely to have standing to pursue a parental relationship unless he's been, in fact, parenting that child.
Yeah,
the boy knew me as his father.
How old is the boy, James?
He's 8 years old.
8 years? Oh, okay.
Okay.
I've been with him all this time.
No, you gotta do something.
So
yeah,
then what? Right. So again, without giving specific legal advice, if someone believes that they are entitled to be recognized as a parent of a child and they're being denied access to that child, what they would be filing is what's called a petition to establish parental relationship with the child. And as I had said before, in California, we do recognize parenting behavior as a basis for establishing a parental relationship.
Yeah.
So, you know, they can recite the facts in their petition as to what their basis is for arguing that they're a parent. And any person who's received a child into their own home and held that child out publicly as their own child in California does have standing to pursue an action to establish a parental relationship as a matter of law.
Should he seek the help of the self-help center of San Francisco County to try to put together a petition?
That would make sense to me as a starting place. Yeah,
you got to try that, James. Go back to the self-help center. I can't tell you where it is, but it's certainly, I think, in the building where the court is.
I believe it's in the courthouse.
Yeah, it's in the courthouse.
Yeah, I went there. They said it can't do anything for me.
Well, all right. Then here's something I want to suggest to you. Do you have any money at all? You have $35?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right. Do you have something to write with?
Okay.
I want you to write down this number.
Okay.
415-989-1616. 415-989-1616. I ask, let me tell you why I'm giving you that number. That's the lawyer referral service for the Bar Association of San Francisco. And so I ask you to turn your radio back up, and I'm going to make an announcement now, but I think you need to call tomorrow to ask if you can have the assistance of someone who is a family law attorney for a half an hour consultation. Mm-hmm. It'll cost you $35. It's a great investment. Doesn't go to the attorney, but goes to the lawyer referral service as a consumer service. So I suggest you do that tomorrow. So turn your radio back up, will you? Thanks for calling. Happy New Year to you. I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco, and if you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For a referral to a lawyer, you can call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own. And, of course, this is during business hours, normal business hours. That number is 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find someone who's experienced for you in the area of law that you're having a problem in, and they'll set you up for a half an hour consultation with the attorney. And in most counties throughout California, for half an hour, it could be maybe $25 or perhaps as much as $35. It's a great thing. And also, James, I want to suggest to you, although it's several weeks away, you can call again on our Call a Lawyer Night, which is going to be the 29th of January. We'll have Call a Lawyer Night. I'll have a family lawyer here who you can talk to off the air on our 800 number, 800-525-9917. But that's going to be not until January 29th. So I wish you good luck. We have a few minutes left. If any of you have any questions in the area of family law and you'd like to pose them to my guests, or if you have some comments or some problems in the area of family law, now is the time to call. Don't wait another 5 minutes or so because the program will be over. The number is 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. Any other? Yeah, Deborah, I see that there's something you want to say.
It's true.
Good thing you're here in the studio with me and not on the phone.
Right, I
wouldn't
have to wave
known
my
that.
Arms.
Yeah.
No, I wanted to say there is another population that this law should really benefit that we were chatting about briefly before we went on air, which is certainly within the Bay Area, there's a fairly significant population of families that have from before conception intended that a child be raised by more than two parents.
Mm.
The most common, I would say the most common of those would be lesbian couples who have chosen who want to have children and have chosen rather than getting sperm from a sperm bank to have either someone's brother or a close family friend provide the sperm and remain involved and be a father to that child. So there are many children in the Bay Area who have two moms and a dad, some have two moms and two dads, who have that's the only configuration they've ever known. I mean, that's how they were planned. That's how they were born, and that's how they've been raised. And up until 10 days ago, when those families would come to me, I would have to tell them that even though they always intended to have more than two people fully involved supporting that child emotionally, financially, and fully involved in that child's life, that they had to pick two for legal purposes.
That's prior to January 1st of this year.
Exactly.
Interesting. Fascinating.
And so now those families and those children will actually have the opportunity to have their full family recognized as a family, and that should be very beneficial to those kids.
Well, that sounds like a great improvement in the law in terms of what the best interests of the child will be.
That's our hope,
Andrew.
To a degree, wrapping up where we started on this. I think we're fortunate to live in a state that recognizes that our definitions of parenting and parenting relationships in the year 2014 aren't what they were in the year 1964, 1974, mm-hmm. maybe even 1984. Mm-hmm. We have an evolved notion of an understanding that what the parenting relationship that a court should recognize should be what truly is in the best interests of that child. And that's what the law continues to move towards. It's the case law and the statutory law. And what this bill is doing is just taking another step in that direction. So to anybody listening who may be taking on an active role parenting a child like your last caller, I would encourage you, if you are in a position where you need to try and establish a parental relationship and you really are the person that child recognizes as being...
Even though you may not be the biological father?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Pick up the phone, call the Loyal Referral Service, call local nonprofit legal mm-hmm. services organizations, and talk about taking that step to establish a parental relationship, because that truly could be what's in the best interest of that child.
We have maybe 2 or 3 minutes at the most left of the program. Would you talk a little bit, because this is a statewide thing, and I think most of these offices, they're either called a self-help center or in the family law context, the family law facilitator's office. Would you both talk just a little bit about that and what that means for people who can't afford attorneys and what they can expect if they go to their county's perhaps called the self-help center or the family law facilitator? Would you talk a little bit about that? Andrew, would you mind doing that?
Sure. So
start it off, because I think people may not, and certainly James, I'm not sure that James understood that, but he did say he went to some office in the courthouse. But
right.
Go ahead.
So most county courts operate systems whereby litigants who don't have the means to hire an attorney on their own can seek legal advice and assistance from attorneys. So attorneys...
Not going into court, but helping them with the paperwork.
Right. So attorneys staff these self-help centers. They don't represent the litigant. So the litigant is still responsible ultimately for filing the paperwork and making the court appearances on their own. But to be able to have that opportunity to have an attorney who's familiar with the process, walk them through the paperwork that's necessary, talk to them about some expectations that they may have in court, is incredibly valuable. But what I want to add on top of that, and this is kind of a selfish thing from my background because I do work at a legal services nonprofit organization, is most big counties also have nonprofit organizations that charge individuals either no fee for service or fees on a sliding scale who can represent them in family law actions or housing
actions.
How
do you find out about them, though?
So typically through the web, or most self-help centers are aware of the existence of these nonprofit organizations.
I see. Okay. You go to the self-help center of the county and right. say, what are the nonprofit organizations that maybe help people in the
right.
family law area?
Right. And so in Santa Clara County, where I practice, for example, if somebody came in and said they had an issue related to children's rights or children's custody, they very well may refer that person to our office for service. So I would recommend looking both at self-help centers, but also the continuum of nonprofit organizations that exist in that county.
I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program. It's been great having you both here. Andrew Kane, chair of the executive committee of the Family Law Section of the State Bar. Deborah Wald, a member of the executive committee of the Family Law Section. Thanks so much.
Our pleasure.
Great
thank
to
you,
have
Chuck.
You both here. Happy New Year to both of you.
Thank you.
Likewise.
Happy New Year.
Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr. Joanne's back after being away for a while. She's a little bit under the weather tonight, but we hope she gets better soon. My production assistant is Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar of California. The additional funding is provided by the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar. The Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, we're going to be talking about consumer scams and issues. We're going to give you an update on what you should be looking out for. Joe Rideout, Manager of Consumer Services for Consumer Action, a nonprofit national consumer advocacy and educational organization, will be here to try to give us a heads up of what we should be looking out for. Happy New Year, everybody. Thanks for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Uh-huh.